Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is World's Greatest Con. I'm Brian Brushwood.
Uri Geller has two reputations. One as a spoonbender, somebody who can melt metal with his mind. That one doesn't scare me. What scares me is his second reputation, as a guy who sues anyone who calls him a fraud. I'm not going to call Uri Geller a fraud, but I will speculate in my heart of hearts that if he were a fraud, the action of whitewashing his own reputation, 50 years of deceptions, falsely accepting fraudulent payments for prospecting to find oil that he may or may not have ever found, the idea of somebody like that being able to get the blessing of the paper of record, the gray lady herself, the New York Times, if any of that were true, it just might be the world's greatest con.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Brian. Gather around, all you rogues and scoundrels, because we are joined again by my co-creator and partner in crime, Justin Robert Young. Justin, how was your week?
It's been a very interesting and fun week, and we're going to talk about why, which is the news peg of this. But I also want to point out that the bulk of this episode is going to be a great interview and conversation that we did with Michael Shermer.
It is a great conversation. The opportunity to sit down with one of my intellectual heroes was fantastic. And it seems like he's very appreciative of our work. And we're going to get to that. But first, bit of news.
A news about the news, which for a journalism major is my favorite kind. Whenever we can discuss journalism as the main character of the story. The New York Times published an article 1 week ago as we record this entitled "The End of the Magic World's 50-Year Grudge." In 1973, Uri Geller claimed to bend metal with his mind on live television. Skeptics couldn't beat him. Now they've joined him, by David Siegel. And what follows is a pretty lengthy and, I would say, charitable. I think I've been more coarse on other platforms that we are on that usually have little bit more lax rules.
I think we could speak plainly about this. Something really curious. We do a comedy podcast every Tuesday night. And when we both read this article, we just kind of rolled our eyes and we're like, Uri Geller's gonna Geller, and we didn't think much of it. And then somebody specifically started asking us for responses. And it turns out once we started talking about it, I don't know about you, but I became angry.
And specifically, if you have not read it, it is explicit in things that I don't think are universally agreed upon and would not take a lot to scratch the surface and find an opposing opinion. Specifically, the idea that Uri Geller is just a coy trickster who has brought material benefit to the world his entire 50-year career. And now, despite the fact that Uri will never say that what he does is magic trickery or illusions, he has found a coterie of magicians who have laid down their qualms that they might have had. They have all agreed that back in the day they might have been sourpusses, and now we can all understand that he's just this strong kayfabe professional wrestling character that has brought such joy to the world over the last 50 years.
And artistically speaking, a case could be made that way, but I think you had a very good metaphor of a dividing line. You said that it's as though the Undertaker accepted millions of dollars to shoot lasers out of his eyes or something.
Yeah, it's the article hand waves away a lot of the talking points that have been made against Uri Geller. Specifically that he has taken money from people under the assumption that he had real powers. The author hand waves away the idea that he took money from mining companies to find oil or ore. We don't know exactly what those deals were for, what he was looking for.
And indeed, he covers for Uri by saying even Uri doesn't really remember how any of that went.
Yeah, so... okay, and then it waits until about three-fourths of the way through the article to even mention what season three of this podcast was all about, the battle between him and James Randi, the amazing James Randi. And that's, I don't think in any way historically accurate. You can have a lot of different opinions about Uri Geller and James Randi, but there is no doubt that they are the Batman and Joker of each other's careers. And you can decide who is who. I know I certainly have my designations personally, but the idea that you would wait in a story that promised a resolution to a 50-year grudge without mentioning the chief antagonist of the grudge is pretty remarkable in how that even hits the paper.
Well, and I we're kind of dancing around it. It's like what I noticed most about the article is, boy, do they not spell out any specific detriment to society that was
yes.
committed by somebody who performed magic tricks and with a straight face claimed, in my opinion, that they were actual miracles bestowed upon him from an extraterrestrial force.
And in further back and forth between the author and other critics, including Kostya Kimlet on Twitter, shout out to Kostya, he has said, can you please name what the harm is? What the material harm is from almost a legal definition? To which some have said, many have said, you know, you could listen to season three of World's Greatest Con, where we make a very compelling argument that not only would the experiments that Mike and Steve participated in as boys have existed if Uri Geller was not saying that he had successfully demonstrated psychic abilities at the Stanford Research Institute, but we wouldn't have had the emotional damage that eventually reflects from it. So it's, if we're looking at adjusted for inflation, millions of dollars spent, not to mention, and I think anybody who's been involved in academics understands that there is a zero sum game when it comes to money that comes into
research. Especially in military and defense investments.
Absolutely. Yeah. There is a zero sum world. So any dollar that is spent in that world is a dollar not spent on something else. And as we know now, something that would have maybe yielded a greater idea of our world and reality more so than parapsychology did.
Economists talk a bit about the seen world and the unseen world, or the seen benefit and the unseen detriment. You see people laughing and clapping and saying hooray and shouting the word bend, and that all feels good. What you don't see are the knock-on detriments of millions of dollars wasted, of, as in season three, lives damaged mm-hmm. by the experience of trying to right what we perceive as a deep wrong that happened. And to see somebody whitewash this reputation so casually, to, in the same article, appear to admit that he's fraudulent, but roll his eyes and say, it's like you're shouting there's no Santa Claus to a bunch of preschoolers. Like,
which for folks who have not read, that is his word for word characterization of the modern critical take on Uri Geller.
Yes, that is the stated thesis that he has, which is quit trying to correct the record, jerks, nerds.
Yeah, if you are critical of Uri Geller, then you are running into a preschool and screaming that Santa Claus doesn't exist, because it is more impactful for our society that Uri be able to live on as a tremendous a living version of a god, even if wink, wink, we all know. And he, wink, wink, doesn't know, because he went to Blackpool and he is involved in this book, which is the news peg of it. And I have a little surprise for you.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Justin, you called me and said, hey, we should maybe record a little something about this. I did not know I was being lured into a trap. What is about to happen?
We have a little bit of a different take on it based on our research that we did for this season.
Yes.
None of which really made it into the season, but we can now reveal it. So I want to give credit to Dustin Dean. He has a website called oneahead.com, which is a magic and mentalism news site by the looks of it. And Dustin did a good job. One might say a better job than the author of the New York Times article, because he contacted the news peg of that New York Times article.
The book.
Specifically, the author of the book, Bend It Like Geller, by Ben Harris, which was published by Vanishing Ink, is the reason why, theoretically, that news article can say that skeptics have laid down their arms against Geller. What seems to be misrepresented in that article is that Bend It Like Geller is, this is according to Harris, as being interviewed by oneahead.com,
the author of the book.
The author of the book. My book, Bend It Like Geller, is about the history and evolution of bending spoons. It is research collection of trick techniques. This is all caps, because I assume this came through in an email. This was not made clear in the New York Times piece. Vanishing Ink did not promote my book as being about Geller. They published my book, Bend It Like Geller. It is an expose of methods for spoon bending. It is not a Geller biography, and it is a skeptical work. So that seems to be a bit different than the way that it is portrayed in the New York Times, doesn't it?
Yes. And at this point, we begin to speculate about how the mental machinations of publishers or I don't want to just make up a story about how this came to be, but it does sound that concrete facts are you and I firmly believe that Geller is doing magic tricks.
Yeah.
You and I believe that James Randi has, his whole quest was, will you please just admit these are magic tricks? Yeah. And Geller refused to. You and I believe that this New York Times article appears to shrug its shoulders and just say, why, who cares whether, like, we all know it's a magic trick. Why don't you quit being babies about it? And it sounds now as though the title and subhead of this article were based on a absolutely erroneous, fallacious contradiction to what the book is about.
Interesting, huh? So then Harris, again, being interviewed for oneahead.com, give them a lot of credit, goes on to talk about how this article came to be. Says, what was supposed to be a story about my book and a celebration of spoon bending's allure to the modern magician for over 50 years turned into something else. But that's just the way the cookie crumbles. Siegel wrote a confronting piece. It's his job. The fallout is the result.
So, I mean, not for nothing, we do take a moment to celebrate the poetry of spoon bending as a way to go. We agree with Ben Harris on that's a very, very good magic trick for a mentalist to do.
Amazing. And by the way, Banachek, who obviously plays a gigantic role in season three, as we tell his and Mike's story of Project Alpha, is quoted extensively in Bend It Like Geller, because most of the actual techniques that are used for metal bending in our modern world are not Geller's. They're Banachek's.
Right, because Banachek out-Gellered Geller, as we talk about in season three. There's that wonderful moment when he's watching the inspiration for all the work he's done, and he realizes, oh, I'm way better than him.
I'm a better magician than this guy. But it got me thinking about some of our conversations that we had both with Mike and Banachek, and specifically around the idea of magic or miracle. Because, and I don't know how much you remember this, when we were talking to them about it, and we couldn't really find a way to fit this into the story because our narrative was really about Mike and Steve and not about Randy. But Randy has never, and you heard in the interview that I forgot I had done with Randy years ago, never mentions magic or miracle in any of his tellings of Project Alpha.
Which I just read as he was really hoping it would be the James Randi show. It turned into a lot of projects kind of do that.
There we go. Right there. Because that was something that was told to us by Banachek and Mike, that it was initially the Randi show. It was the Randi travels the world and finds some things for which he absolutely cannot explain, like the ability to walk across hot coals.
Which is a real phenomenon based on thermal lag, but it was poorly understood at the time. Yeah.
Yep. And reveals other things like psychic surgery. But that's not, and I really, really wish that George Schlatter Productions would put this on
YouTube or something
somewhere. The bulk of that special is this back and forth between Randy and Geller. And they've shot a lot of stuff of Geller doing certain stuff. And the beginning of the episode is the narrator reading off all these fanciful things. But first, the psychic battle of the century. I think we even use that clip in the show. And it goes right into Geller says he's real. Randy says he's not. And they go back and forth, and it's Geller talking and it's Randy talking. And from everything that we have heard from at least Mike and Steve, Randy was very upset that Geller essentially hijacked
his opportunity.
He made it all close about himself. And I wonder if we don't know what has gone on in the process of creating this, but if maybe, much like George Schlatter Productions way back in the early 80s, a story about something else that involved getting comment from Geller all of a sudden found itself morphing by some unseen hand, not unlike a spoon bending, to the will of the person holding it.
Justin, can I share with you a totally unrelated recommendation? There's an Idris Elba starred vehicle on Apple TV Plus that me and the family are enjoying. It's called Hijack.
Yes. I mean, we don't know, but based on what Ben Harris said this was supposed to be and how upset it feels like he is for essentially being pinned as the poster boy for the fact that all magic and skepticism now loves Uri Geller, it would not shock me if history has repeated itself. I mean, that special was in 1983. So if 40 years on, the exact same phenomenon happened yet again.
And you know what?
The paper of record.
A little bit of a preview here. We're going to do an interview with the authors of the upcoming book. I guess it's out now, Nobody's Fool. And one of the chapters is dedicated to the idea of how rarely we check to see what somebody's past track record is when we accept their claims. And so very often, it's not the first time that if so, when you get deceived, you go back and you're like, oh yeah, no, definitely arrested this time, that time, that time, the other time, this was a lawsuit and so on. If past performance is any indicator of future results, I guess the history record speaks for itself.
Anything else on this? I mean, I think the other element of all this is that me and you both know how this process works with Geller, that any kind of attention, you
becomes
know,
becomes good attention for him. Because, yeah.
I mean, he is the reason why him and Randy had such an epic feud for as long as they did is because both of them were not just good, but expert at making any motion from the other one into a meal that benefited them.
Well, then let me throw this out there. I am personally, Brian Brushwood, of the opinion that you're 100% correct. And part of me, the human Brian Brushwood, is a little bit embarrassed to even being drawn into the discussion about this because Geller benefits. But what if, like the relationship between him and Randy, we were able to benefit? For example, what if everybody listening made a habit of encouraging people to listen to episode one of season three of World's Greatest Con?
Yeah, wherein we talk very specifically about Geller's effect, not only on parapsychology, but academics in general. And then we tell a very small story about only one example of $4 million adjusted for inflation being lost. So there we go. That is our thoughts. I know a lot of people have reached out to us about it, and it felt right to have some kind of comment here, especially now that we've got more information that has come out about the sourcing on the article.
All right. So enough about the New York Times article. The important thing is that we got to sit down with a name that is as synonymous to skepticism, at least in my upbringing, as James Randi himself. Michael Shermer was gracious enough to stop by the studio, and we got a long interview with him.
We did. He was incredibly gracious with his time, and even more gracious to listen to our entire season. As it turns out, that man bicycles a lot.
Yeah. And as somebody who's done a triathlon or three, I can agree. You want something in your ears at all times.
Absolutely. And we were honored that it was us. And so what follows is a conversation with Michael Shermer, not only about season three, but also about skepticism and the skeptic community, and a little bit about James Randi as well.
And again, if you have a friend who you hear talking about that New York Times article, please just do us a solid. Make them listen.
Season three, World's Greatest Con.
And that's why I need your money right now. Man, how do we begin? We're here with Justin Robert Young, Michael Shermer. This is a moment I never thought I would experience. This is precious and powerful to me. I don't know which one of us should be asking questions of whom.
Well, we can just, have the conversation ricochet around the table and see what comes up. I would ask you guys, I'm very interested in the psychology of belief, why people believe weird things, is my first book, right? So why people believe anything. And then in cognitive psychology circles, there's this sort of division between how gullible and susceptible people are to cons and scams and so on. We're just inherently irrational. The whole Danny Kahneman, Amos Tversky stuff about, cognitive biases, confirmation bias,
system one, system two,
and that we're just sort of hopelessly irrational. And look at, here's 100 different, cognitive biases. You can look up on Wikipedia. It's like, how does anybody even get out of bed and go to work? We're so irrational. But then there's other cognitive psychologists that say, no. Actually, if it's presented in the proper way, people are actually pretty rational most of the time, right? So it's not clear which is the correct answer to this, So I'll just set it up and just ask you guys
I'll go first. I think we're talking about heuristics. And heuristics are give it a bad rap because heuristics are what cause us to ascribe negative things to situations and people just kind of automatically at a gut level. But also they're probably
various tribes 10,000 years ago who had a heuristic of the other equals bad were more likely to survive than the other equals invite them in.
Right.
Yeah, I think that, you know, even the framing of a question like that is really a slave to narratives. We have this narrative that by purging the irrationalities, we will become more rational and live a better life. And that is certainly a goal to have, to confront elements of your existence for which you can make better. But I do think on some level it is, if anything, almost harmful when we look at our own behavior and say, if I have a flaw, I mean, there's a reason why we were hanging out earlier and Brian was doing magic tricks for you. It doesn't make you stupid that you didn't know how the magic trick was going to be done. It made you human that you were going to focus on a certain thing. And magic is the art, much in the same way the cons are, of exploiting those holes. So the reason why we have World's Greatest Con and the central thesis is cons don't fool us because we're stupid. They fool us because we're human. And, and to assign morality and virtue and
intelligence,
being broken if you are not to it, I think only cements us in this idea that we're not just flawed machines, that like any machine can be hacked.
That's where I'm leaning now on that debate. I think, like, you showed me the you know, pick a book off the shelf here, flip to any page. The book looks exactly like the books that I recognize. Why would I think this is a artificially constructed book where every page has these certain words and you're going to get them? I wouldn't think that, because normally that's not the way the world works, right? So, like, I did a series of experiments for Dateline NBC with Chris Hansen, which we replicated famous psych experiments, like Milgram's shock experiments. But we did the smoke in the room. So this is at NBC Studios. The subjects are just people trying out for this reality show called What a Pain. And so they're filling out their forms. And we start pumping theater smoke into the room, right? So everybody there is a shill working for us, except for the one guy that's our subject, right?
It doesn't even smell like actual fire smoke.
No. But, you know, and you see him, he's like, and then he looks at, you know, okay. And then he goes back, you know, to.
Yeah. And meanwhile, everybody else is acting like just, nothing's weird.
Right. But if you think, then everybody laughs, you know, these people are so stupid that they fall for this. Well, normally, if you were in a room and there was smoke pouring in it, you guys wouldn't just sit there. And if you were just sitting there, because we're in a studio, I think this has got to be theater smoke. These are magicians. I know they're hacking me here or something. But normally, so social proof, right? You turn to other people and think, well, that's, I can trust them for the most part. You know, pull the audience. It works pretty well for most things, right? And who has time to fact check everything that happens? Right.
Well, and more importantly, who could function as a human in society if you're going to question, like, is that light really red or is it green? You know, like at some point you have to take most points at face value.
Right.
Well, yeah, you or else we would just be constantly questioning everything at all times. We're all making assumptions. We're making assumptions about how we comb our hair or how we dress or where we are or the fact that you're really in Austin, Texas, and you're not on Mars right now. Like, there's a lot of stuff that we just have to build. And that's why it's like when we say narratives, I think it's necessary. It's part of our processing so we can understand where we are. Now, there are ways in which we do it. There's ways in which we gather and predictably put together what we assume to be our reality. And that's where I think for you know, what to Brian's point, whenever you are looking at a thing that could only in your mind take tremendous effort, like that person who's sitting there and is like thinking about, should I freak out? Should I not freak out? Everybody else is calm. In his mind, probably subconsciously, there's a thought of, well, I mean, I'm not on a television set with a bunch of actors and this is canola oil and Michael Shermer is behind the scenes. Like, that's certainly not the case. I guess this is just a thing that happens and maybe, you know, Dracula's farting and like that's why I should keep filling out.
I want to live my life as though Michael Shermer is always behind the scenes of everything.
Well, it's like that Darren Brown special, The Push, you know, like how many steps you have to go through to get somebody to walk up to somebody sitting on a wall on a high rise and shove them off. And it took a lot, right? So it's not like people are so stupid, they'll just do whatever you tell them. Go push that guy off the bridge. Okay, well, they don't do that.
Well,
you have to have like 100 steps to get him
Darren is a special case.
But he's so brilliant because
what do you mean? You're not telling me some of this was not what it looked like?
Regardless of how the method's done,
okay.
The brilliance of Darren Brown is that he makes what we were just talking about as the thing that you would definitely not think his art. So he, in his specials, and he's done this repeatedly and in his live shows, talks about all the little things that are going to have to happen to make this extraordinary thing possible. Mm. Is that exactly how it's done? Probably. Who knows? That's the magic of Darren Brown.
So maybe that's misdirection.
Michael, here's a totally unrelated, totally separate story.
In no way connected.
You are familiar with something called the Texas sharpshooter fallacy, right?
Yeah.
How do you describe that?
Yes. Oh, well, you just shoot at a barn and then you walk up and draw the bullseye around your shots.
That's a good way to do it. magicians have something called a dual reality where a pretty good trick happens to somebody on stage, but an amazing trick is perceived by the audience.
I see.
Darren Brown is a very good magician. And it seems to me, and this is my favorite thing, this is why I intentionally don't find out how many things are done, because if I don't know how it's done, I feel ethically free to suspect how I would do it. Mm. New story, here's how I might do something like that. I might get a result, and then after the fact, manufacture a narrative that acts as though that was the intended result.
That's really funny.
And we see this not only on magic shows, but also hypothetically, I don't know, which is why I get to speculate, on Bryce's favorite show from Nathan For You. What was that show?
The rehearsal.
Right? Whatever.
Brian was not fooled.
I was not fooled. But the point is there's the in-the-moment narrative, and then there's how you present the narrative. And I think Darren Brown is one of the greatest masters to ever perfect that art, to make both parties satisfied, because the people were genuinely fooled in the moment, but the people at home got an even better story.
Mm.
End press release.
You mean, so when they make the actual documentary and they reconstruct how they did all this, that could be somewhat artificial in the same way that scientists run experiments. They run like 9 different experiments and 3 of them are significant. The others just go in the file drawer. And then they write up the paper. Here was my methods. I did this and this and this, and we found this and this and this. And they don't mention all the messiness. Yeah. And we tried this, we tried that, nothing worked. Spent years doing this and we finally got this. That's all you read about.
Well, and I believe that bias exists in all of our lives at all levels. For example, I'm 48 years old now, doing okay as an independent content creator, and people ask me, how did you do it? And what I'm tempted to do, because of where I am, is draw a thread back to performing on a street corner and figure out what are all the right things I do. So with a straight face and actually believing it, I might want to say, well, you got to do this and that and think about this or whatever. But truthfully, I cannot remember all of the failed attempts and I cannot figure out how many of those things were just dumb luck or coincidence or what have you. Only, you know, if you're giving a magic show, maybe you do a little bit more of that on purpose.
It's all like that. It's the hindsight bias. I call it the autobiography bias, you know, the sort of unauthorized autobiography. Here's how I did it.
Yeah.
When in fact, you know, like in my case, so you go to college and then you don't get into grad school. So you get a job at a bike magazine and you become a bike racer and then you teach at night and then you do this and then you start a magazine and here you are. It's like, what?
Think about it, like some 16-year-old who's like, oh my God, Michael Shermer, I want to be just like Michael Shermer. I guess the first thing I have to do is be very good at riding bikes. It's like, that will not lead you to being Michael Shermer.
No.
But that goes back to the stories that we tell of ourselves and that we demand from the rest of the world. Like the reason why Darren Brown is so successful is because he put, especially for his era of magic, more artistry and story in both his live shows and his television specials than really anything else that was in the field. Nobody else was putting that kind of narrative into it.
What
was
it called? Miracle, where he kind of debunks the faith healers by being a faith healer himself on stage.
Yeah.
Now, some of this, standard mentalism, some stuff, it looked like he was actually doing hypnosis, where the person, he tells the person, you won't be able to, under hypnosis, you won't be able to read this headline, right? Everybody can see what the headline is. And then the guy's reading, and then all of a sudden he can't read it anymore. Now, I assume that guy's not a plant. Is he actually able to read it and he's going along with it? Or is it like the old hypnosis trick where, you know, after I wake you up, you will not be able to say the number 7. And then they wake him up, count to 10, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 9, 10. And they can't seem to say it. I can't tell if they're going along with it.
As best I understand it, and my experience is less academic and more watching a friend of mine become a stage hypnotist for 20 years. As best I can understand, there is a spectrum of people who are able to be fully in state at any time.
Absorption, that's called.
Yes, and some of them who are very good at it, at doing it on cue, go to Hollywood and become famous actors, and they're not faking when they cry, right? And as a result, we watching the movie lose ourselves in that moment and actually cry or whatever. There are some people who are better able to do that than others. Stage hypnosis, and there's therapeutic hypnosis, which, you know, that's where you get into double blind trials of whether or not it's more effective for stopping smoking or eating less or whatever. Setting all of that aside, the moment of theatrical hypnosis, it does seem like there's a giant, let's say you have 2,000 people in the audience. That's a good data set, right? From all types. You have a statistically significant number of people who are able to self-select for, number one, wanting to play along. And some number of those are going to be the type of people who are somebody who can instantly put themselves in any state that they're given. And then over the course of 45 minutes, they are trained, makes it seem like they're a puppy dog, which of course they're not, they're humans, but they are accustomed to the game. And then they're said, and now this happened or whatever. And one of my friends was one of those subjects where he won $1 million, air quotes. And afterwards, people would ask him, hey man, where's that check? And he actually reached for his pocket.
Really?
And it was like, oh. And to hear him describe it, this is my interpretation, but it sounded an awful lot like, have you ever had a dream and you know it was a dream, but you forgot that you knew it was a dream. And later in the day, something happens. You're like, oh yeah, screw that guy. Oh no, wait, no, that was a dream. Like that's right. Where you seem to end up, as best I can tell.
Yeah. I think that's probably right. There's this thing called absorption where there's an absorption scale. You take this little test. Like, do you ever find yourself staring at the ocean and just you're kind of mesmerized and minutes go by? You know, some people know, some people, yeah, totally, right? So if you score pretty high on this, these people are more likely to hear voices or sense presence. They have sleep paralysis or hypnopompic hallucinations. But more the kind of sense presence of somebody else in the room. With me, you know, this is a phenomenon. It's not huge, but people high in absorption are more likely to have those kind of imaginary things that happen. And so I do. So you mentioned if you have 1,000 people in the audience. It's a good data set. Do you mean by that the hypnotist does a bunch of stuff before the show starts, or we see the TV show starts filming, in which they have people raise their hand and then lower your hand, and they end up with like 100 and then down to 10. And these are the 5 people I'm bringing up on stage.
This is another great moment where I get to speculate because I don't know. Here's how I would do it.
Okay.
I would do all of those pre-selection activities. I would do things like tell people, clasp your hands together. The harder you try to pull apart your hands, the more stuck together they become. And I would have spotters telling me, who's doing what or whatever. And then I might make a moment of you, and then get them up, not entirely on stage, but maybe get 50 of them and do more filtering activities. And then finally say, okay, you 20 stand here. Then I would go up and I would say from stage, I need volunteers, about 20 of them. Please come up. And then that's all the home audience would see.
Right.
That's if I was doing this. Right. I cannot speak for anybody else.
There is intro of our second season of World's Greatest Con, where Brian does an entire breakdown of a stage hypnotist act. And specifically, like for a television show, that is a great element of pre-work. But if you're just at a college and this is just all going to be packed into a 90-minute thing where you come on at a certain time, you got to leave at a certain time, it's remarkable how much our human desire to fit in, to be recognized, to not be uncomfortable, and the little ways that we will push our own boundaries or maybe even secretly fulfill a desire to be the center of attention will allow you to be theatrically put into a position where it looks very credibly to the audience that you are dancing like Britney Spears because you are fully under hypnosis.
Right. So I got a funny story for you. So one of my kids' friend's parents is over visiting, and he's a kind of a skinny guy, and so he sees I have a chess set. He goes, "Oh, you play chess?" I go, "Yeah, a little bit, you know." He goes, "Oh, you know, I used to play the grandmasters and stuff." I'm like, "Oh, well, you know, you don't want to play me. I can't even beat level one on my computer, right?" And then, you know, and then I got a tennis racket. "Oh, you play tennis?" Yeah, a little bit, you know, just for fun. "Well, I play with Jimmy Connors. He and I hit all the time." This is in Santa Barbara. I'm like, "Okay, that's two that are, it's a bit of a stretch. All right, maybe." And then, you know, we talk about I'm a cyclist, right? So, you know Lance Armstrong. "Yeah, I know Lance Armstrong, the doping." He's, "Oh, I used to be a big doper. You know, when I was in Special Forces, I was just totally ripped. I was taking testosterone and steroids, the whole thing. I mean, we were down there, you know, eliminating dictators and stuff with the Special Forces." Like, you got a picture. The guy sitting across from me looks like Pee Wee Herman, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And at this point, I'm like, you know, at three strikes and you're out.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, that man, the Pope.
Yeah. You know, so how many cues do you need before somebody's skepticism kicks in?
Well, there's a bit of a filtering mechanism. Like, I, on purpose, once I quit my day job, started touring as a magician, started telling stories online, started, you know, doing a little bit of TV here or there. You know, I've collected stories that have informed business decisions. Like, it's not entirely an accident that I bought a crazy person compound, right? Because I'm attracted to crazy people.
Yes.
But if I were to just out of nowhere say, "Oh yeah, no, I'm a nationally famous touring Tonight Show performing guy who bought a crazy nudist cult compound that was where the satanic panic happened." Like, if I gave you all of that at once, that would be like, "You're an asshole and you're making up all of this." However, in pieces, like, these are trophies on the shelf that I've collected over time. And I know that I have learned to parcel them out even when they're true. But it sounds like this guy, you got the impression that the guy was making up everything whole cloth.
Yeah, but see, I can't fact check any of that. I wouldn't even know who to call in the Special Forces. Is this guy on your, you know, whatever? I'm not, you know, he's not interviewing for a job or something like that. But so you just kind of have to default to trust for most of the time, because most people don't make up stories about how they were in Special Forces or whatever. And I'll tell you another funny story. This has to do with cycling. There was a guy, like a 45-year-old cyclist, and he's on Strava, which is this app where you record all your
rides,
and everybody sees what everybody else is doing. You can see the average speed and which climb and so on. Anyway, this guy was a total imposter, con man, so on. And he told people he was, you know, the CEO of a major corporation in Europe. He was a pro racer in his 20s. He was in Special Forces. He did all these things. But nobody checked. And he carried this on for years until finally he posted a stage on Strava where he was like faster than the fastest Tour de France rider did that climb. And somebody went, "That guy did not do that." That I could fact check because I know that climb, right?
Right. Yeah.
And that's what brought him down. Because otherwise, how would you fact check stuff like that?
Well, and also it's, what is that person's worth to you? You know, we are always constantly looking around and assessing our own status and assessing who can help us, who we like, who we don't like. Sometimes we have friends that are, you know, kind of rakes, or they might make things up every now and again. But we like them. We enjoy their company. We don't want to embarrass them. Sometimes there are people that we just absolutely loathe and despise and wish would leave the planet immediately that we kind of have to begrudgingly concede are honest, or at least have a code for which they follow. These things are messy. So it doesn't surprise me that somebody would be able to be a complete fabulist as long as with other elements of their social status, they are fitting into the world. And people might think, okay, well, let's say 50% of what he's saying is total horse poop. Like, maybe the other 50 can help me. Maybe I can get ahead in life.
Well, and that's an interesting question because I know for sure
until you fraudulently list a bike run and ostracized
now
forever.
You're out of the line. No, I know for sure that there are friends that I invite to parties that I don't believe half of what they say, but I know it'll be a better party because they're there. And I know that there are people who invite me to parties who probably don't believe half the stuff I say because it'll be a better party for it. Which I guess brings us back to storytelling. And you have a unique talent, Michael, I think, of navigating. When I first got into skepticism, it was all about facts because in a pre-internet era when it was difficult to do fact-checking, some wild claims would be made and there was no way to push back on them. And then now we're able to, you know, somebody can post a YouTube video saying, I'm trying to do this thing, looks an awful lot like total BS or whatever. But you, among most skeptics, have surprised me with, you seem warm to the idea that story matters and that there's storytelling aspects and archetypes that we're drawn to for various reasons. Maybe I'm misreading it, but does that, number one, ring true? And would you like to elaborate on that at all?
Well, I'm a writer, so you have to tell a story or else you're just writing a textbook, right? And I'm not a textbook writer. So, yeah. My favorite authors are also good storytellers, you know, Richard Dawkins and Stephen Jay Gould and Steven Pinker, you know, science writers that also can write a beautiful narrative arc for each chapter, for the whole book. You know, it's outlined and so on. And to me, that makes all the difference in the world. I think this is my explanation for the Jordan Peterson phenomenon, is that he's not just a good storyteller. The first time I saw him on stage, it was just at some conference and before he was really famous. And, you know, like each of the previous speakers was kind of giving their normal talk with the PowerPoint slides, just, you know, a real snoozer. And he just gets up there and says, well, I was thinking about, you know, I've been thinking all day about what you guys wanted to talk about today. And, you know, I was reading Nietzsche this morning and he, you know, and I just had this idea. And I tied it to Jung, you know, this question that you brought. And everybody's like, oh, my God, what is he talking about? And then, you know, he's on this story. Right. I thought that guy's good. Right.
He was fully present in the moment. And
right.
He talked about everybody's favorite subject, themselves.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, there's a great anecdote that came out right when Boris Johnson became prime minister of the United Kingdom. And this guy was telling this story about how the first time that he saw Boris Johnson speak, it was at some staid, you know, conservative event in London. And the people there, as you might imagine, are very, very rigid about their timing and hoping everybody's there. And Boris Johnson's the headliner, but he's not there. And so they're starting to panic. They're calling him and they can't get in touch with him. And then they're asking other people, hey, if he doesn't show up, can you go last? And blah, blah, blah. Then all of a sudden, about 5 minutes before he's supposed to go on, Boris Johnson comes busting in. He's like half sweating. He's got, you know, he's barely put together. And he's like, oh, it turns out like my speech got left. I came here as fast as I can. I'll just go up there and wing. He's going to wing it. So he does. And he kills, just absolutely slays. He brings and admits up on stage, you know, I just got here. I don't have my speech with me. But, you know, rub the forehead, goes off and absolutely murders the crowd. Everybody loves him. And the end of that column is the second time that I saw Boris Johnson speak. Right. He was late. He showed up 5 minutes right. And it was the exact same speech.
Carefully planned randomness.
But when you think about it, it's like, what makes that special? Mm. Part of it, of course, from the perspective of the speaker is that you seem like you are a high wire person. You read into who his character is, who he is, who he isn't. In a world of staid people, he is a bit of a rebel. But also it's story. Immediately, and these are the most powerful characters, the most powerful mythos, the most powerful archetypes are people that you know immediately where they're coming from and what they're doing. And that's something that I think is extraordinarily powerful, especially in the world of cons, where you need to put a lot of story in a little bit of time.
I don't like where this positions me because we talk about the asymmetry of the con man being able to prepare for a moment long in advance. But I know you do a lot of talks, and hopefully this doesn't make me look like a con man. But every time I give a talk, I intentionally put tedious citation slides for the purpose of me to say, oh, we don't have time for this dumb garbage, just so I can have that moment of making everybody feel appreciated. I don't know if that makes me a bad person or
that's
not.
That's really funny. Well, since you guys are magicians, I'll tell you this. When I saw David Copperfield live for the first time, Civic Auditorium in Pasadena, late 90s, I think it was. So he took a group of skeptics there and for the afternoon show. And it was great. Of course, he did all his usual stuff. But he had this one thing. He's like, okay, I'm going to randomly pick somebody from the audience. He throws the ball out or whatever he did to make it seem random. And he ends up with this cute kid that's like 12 years old. And he's got the card in the envelope on the wall. Okay, now you have to keep an eye on this thing. He gives him these little plastic binoculars. Don't take your eyes off that card, right? And then he does whatever he does, right? Anyway, so then later for the evening show, well, some of the other people couldn't make it. So I said, all right, I'll take you guys to the evening show. I don't mind seeing it a second time. So again, random person from the audience. Same kid. I'm like, oh, even that was planned. And it looks so random. And why would it matter? Well, because he's cute and I don't know.
Well, and there is kind of a just so-ness. I don't want to get into the business of deconstructing Copperfield's act in particular, but I do know that sometimes in his show, something would happen organically. And after the show, it was agreed by everybody that that was the best moment ever.
I see.
And then it happened again.
That's funny, because I wanted to ask you about cults and cons. To what extent do these cult leaders or con men, by trial and error, end up at a really effective method to get people to join or give their money or whatever? And we don't see the back end. Like, this guy tried 10,000 different things to get somebody to give them their money, and this is the one that worked. And now we see, oh, that's the con, but we don't see the back end.
We've not talked about this on air, but I suspect that more rather than less, con men or cult leaders really begin believing what they're doing.
Right.
But at some point, the stakes get high enough that they have to figure out how to keep on creating miracles. And you see this in marketing with what I've heard called guru-itis of like, no, whatever I say is the best way to market or whatever. You see this in branding. You see this in performances. But I believe very few people begin with malintent in mind. Mm-hmm. I think they take shortcuts, but then we are uncomfortable with the historical record and we have to reconcile why I didn't do that because I was scared or lazy and I wanted to pinch off this bit from so-and-so. So I'm now going to decide that that guy was always evil and I'm the first one to finally reveal whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Does that land?
Yeah, I personally, I would like to put con men and cult leaders in kind of two separate buckets, because I think that like there's an element of that for cult leaders for sure. If you look at the history of cults, very often it starts out as something that is almost like,
even Scientology began as a rejection of the rigid structure of psychiatry. It's like, here's a open source way for everyone to take care of themselves. Oh, wait, is there no money in open source ways? Here's a new, highly rigid structure that is the real way.
Whereas con men, in the way that I think it's probably most commonly referred to, are basically people who are like, oh, I would like money. Well, I can punch this person and take it, but that would make my hand hurt. How do I do it without making my hand hurt? And that's where you get short changes and
also all faster.
Yeah, exactly. It's faster and it's cleaner and you can get away with it. And you can probably be farther enough away by the time that somebody realizes that they got, because part of what cons take advantage of are you thinking that you're getting ahead in some way? And so you are co-opting them into something dirty that they then just want the shame to go away. And so if they had to pay whatever amount that they just got finessed for, that is what it is. And it's the reason why on our show, we never want to lionize the con man. That it's not something that I think we have a reflexive reaction to movies and television shows about con men, where everything is this Rube Goldberg, you know, Ocean's 11. Well, you cough, and then I'll do a backflip, and then somebody, the waiter, will you know, slip the thing and the other thing. Very often, cons are pretty rudimentary. You know, they're clever. They are something that exploits an element of our humanity, but they're not these grand, brilliant plans. And so we wind up focusing more on the marks than we do on the con men, specifically because that's where we think the drama really is.
But the cons know what works for the marks by how? Trial and error?
Throughout history, sure.
They have an intuitive guess as to what's going to work. But remember, we're only counting the successes. We're not telling stories about the failures.
In other words, if I ask for the money at week three, that didn't work. I'll wait till week five after I do these other things, then I'll get the money. And he tries it 100 times. Week five is the time to ask for the money.
Correct. Our core thesis is the con man isn't smart. The mark is not stupid. Two humans playing a forever chess game.
That's good.
We only know the stories of the cons that worked, and we have yet to find out what is a con right now. You know, for example, let's say we were doing this series 2 years before Bernie Madoff got figured out. Mm. He would not be on our list to even talk about.
Right.
It's only after the hindsight bias that we get to reveal.
Well, and also it's like the times that don't work are stupid, right? In our first episode, the first thing that you hear out of Brian's mouth is him getting scammed in for fake speakers that
white
we were
speaker
told.
Scam,
He was told were amazing, and
what was this?
The story is basically 21-year-old Brian. Let me get these flies. There we go. The story is basically a 20-year-old Brian is at a Home Depot. A couple guys hop out of a white van saying that they had studio monitors. They were supposed to only have four that went to this strip club. They had two extras. Look at this magazine. Same picture, same thing. Normally they're $1,200, but let them go for $300. And meanwhile, I'm thinking, oh, you're trying to scam a scammer. I know these are stolen. I would like to give you $300. But because I was buying, like, what am I going to do when I find out that they're garbage speakers? Am I going to call the cops? Am I going to call the Better Business Bureau and right. say, I was trying to buy good quality stolen speakers? That trap tends to close off that loop.
Mm. But think of the ones that don't work. It's somebody right. saying, hey, I got speakers. And you go, nah. And that's right. it, right? right. Like, and, right. and so it's low test, it's low risk.
Yes.
You can throw that bait out as many times as you want. It doesn't feel illegal in that moment, and you know, eventually you get a Brian who's 21 and really, really into speakers.
So one of the most extraordinary parts about doing this season is the fact that you, somebody who I have followed and respected for decades, gave it your full attention. Thank goodness you drive very long bicycle rides.
Listen to the whole thing in one day.
You burned through everything. What was that experience like for you? How much baggage did you come into Project Alpha with, and how much of that was a surprise to you?
Well, most of it was a surprise in the details, but I had the same just kind of meme story of, you know, Randy hired these two kids and sent them in because he wanted to fool the scientists, because that was Randy's thing. You know, scientists are not trained to have to know what magicians can see. So you got to have a magician on your team when you're testing the paranormal. Right. That was always his thing. Now, I think that was probably a hindsight bias himself. Like,
but and also practice. Not untrue. I mean, he was
that's
right. right.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. But, you know, I always thought, well, so the two boys were just sent in. I didn't know that they were going to go in anyway. And then Randy came on board later. You know, it was obviously a team effort. And so, yeah, all the details of that were astonishing, especially the on the fly, you know, just real time adjustments that the boys had to make to figure out how are we going to do this. And I always thought, well, they just called Randy, you know, we're back at the hotel. This is what they're going to do tomorrow. What do we do? And no, that wasn't what happened, as I discovered.
Yeah. In fact,
it was the other way around. They were calling Randy and telling them
what
they did. And then Randy would write a letter saying, hey, I don't know what you guys are doing, but if anybody's doing a thing with a bell jar, then you should really cover the bottom because somebody might be blowing.
So I'm trying to tee up a question. Anyway, any other thoughts about the experience of hearing the full story? Because we were very nervous going into this because we knew that there had existed for 40 years an official narrative. We were talking to first sources. We are not the founder and editor-in-chief of Skeptic Magazine, so we did not know exactly what lines we were crossing.
We should write this up for as an article in Skeptic because this is part of classic history of skepticism, you know, because most of what we get, this is a big problem in science too, you know, is that we're not actually getting the full story. And the full story is always way more interesting. You know, it just gets filtered down to this really simple story, like the eclipse experiments that tested Einstein's theory of relativity that Sir Arthur Stanley Eddington did. The standard story you get in the textbook is that in 1919, there's a solar eclipse. Einstein had predicted that light would bend around a large gravitational mass like the sun, and gravity is a distortion of that kind of well of space-time, and it's bending. It's not being pulled by some force, right? So how would you test that? Well, you have to have an eclipse because the starlight behind the sun, you can't see during the day because the sun's on, right? But an eclipse would it. So he figured this out. So he sends the team out there. They photograph it, and the, you know, the measurements, the starlight from the back stars passing past the sun are bent exactly the way Einstein predicted, right? And that's not at all what happened. In fact, there were actually two teams that were sent out. One team, it was cloudy and they just got next to no data. And the other team, the data was kind of in between what Newton predicted versus what Einstein predicted. And then they had to do some more measurements and it turned out Einstein was right and Newton was not as right. But the whole story takes like a full chapter in a history of science book, whereas in textbooks you get like the two paragraph description.
Well,
this happens everywhere, right? What's the real story? It's always more interesting.
Well, and messy. Also more tedious, right?
Tedious, messy. It's not as clean. You know, the famous, world famous, Amazing Randy does this thing, and then he's got a series of hits. You know, the pop off expose. He's on the Tonight Show, and he does this and this and this. You know, from an escape artist to this. And it's just, it's a great narrative. It's a story, right? It's the story we want.
I also wonder, as we move through our internet world, where the one thing that has changed forever is scarcity. Like you mentioned a textbook, that story is you only get X amount in the textbook. And that has just as much to do about the fact that the textbook can only be so many pages because that's what the budget is, as it is for any other reason. Now in our world of infinite audio and text that we and video that we have on the internet effectively, you know, forever. I wonder if nuance and our ability to find things easier and put them together with like AI is something that we will have more of that hopefully, at least for me, because I agree with you that very rarely, especially when we're talking about big figures that people have a lot of esteem for, the reality of their lives are far more fascinating than the myths. The myths are there to serve a purpose. The actual reality is something that I think we can actually see ourselves in, which is more important.
I think some of that too is, you know, Randy was a big personality, entertaining, fun, interesting, and a great storyteller. And there aren't many like that. Bill Nye's like that. I know Bill pretty well. Neil deGrasse Tyson's a good friend. He's like that. And so when I meet scientists going, you know, how come Bill Nye gets all that TV? Neil deGrasse Tyson gets his own show. It's like they say it like, well, you know, it was random, or how come I don't get the show? Well, have you tried going on television and try to be funny? You can't do it. You're going to be like the people on American Idol. I can sing. No, actually, you can't.
Yeah.
Right?
It is a tournament. It's a crucible. It's a grueling, awful meat grinder of a factory where only the simplest and plainest and most direct narrative seemed to emerge on the other end.
Bill Nye was a comedian, stand-up comedian in Seattle before he was Bill Nye the Science Guy. And then after that, he was the weatherman.
Yeah.
And then he's introducing humor into the weather report. And then he does this and this and this. And then Bill Nye, the Science Guy. So you don't see the back end. Right. And Neil tells the story of, you know, the first time he was asked to be on one of those late night shows, and he rehearsed and practiced. He says, I got 6 minutes and this is what I want to say. And I'm going to throw these lines in. I'm going to do this. So it was well rehearsed. And then, but the way he does it, because he's so entertaining, he's bigger than life character, it comes off as totally spontaneous. I was once on Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect, the previous show. So he had four guests, so it was two and two. And I was sitting next to Kevin Nealon, from Saturday Night Live. Sure. And he was really funny. I mean, he was just coming up with stuff like this. I'm like, God damn, I wish I was funny. I'm just not a funny guy. And then on the first commercial break, he pulls out this little index card and I look and he's got the lines. Yep. I'm like, oh, dang.
I mean, that's straight up magic. It's like if you don't question first principles. Now, of course, we can't live our whole lives questioning first principles on everything. But yeah. So I do have one question. I kind of want to go to skeptic confession here. Your newest book is about conspiracies, right? There is one. I'm a pretty good skeptic about most things,
but.
But when I hear a
we have an amazing opportunity. I'm really glad that you're getting along.
Do you take American Express?
But whenever I see a narrative presented that is just so, that is perfectly tidy, that is just right, I always ask myself, if I were going to just shoot straight for that thing, is there a shorter path? And I'm thinking... much to my great chagrin, we recently, Jeff put together an amazing article that's on the Modern Rogue right now, where we found out that Frank Abagnale's incredible story of Catch Me If You Can, like, you know, if you want to be famous for being a liar who lied his way around the world, why would you bother to lie your way around the world? Why not just skip to the part where you lie about having lied around the world? And the evidence is mounting that that's what he did. So I
really exaggerated some of his own cons.
Let's say euphemistically what you just said. Yes.
Really?
Between the ages of 16 and 21, most of his time was spent in prison. Hypothetically, according to science, if he passed as many checks as he claimed to during that time, he would have to pass 800 checks per day. I found out that day that Santa Claus was maybe not real.
God, that's incredible.
So I maintain this bias, and I know it comes from the same place that conspiracy theorists want to create more complicated narratives for things than maybe it merits. Where does that come from? And I assume you explore this part of the neuroscience in the book.
That's interesting. Okay, Frank, you just blowing my mind.
Yeah.
So the con man is exaggerating his own cons.
Why wouldn't you, though, right? It's once you hear it, you're like, skip the part where I went to jail in France.
Right. That's so funny. I guess once you're busted, then I might as well just go for it. That's really funny. Yeah. Well, conspiracy theories do a number of things. They cut through the messiness of life, the contingent randomness of life. You know, we're not good at just detecting randomness. You know, there's experiments on this. Like if I have you randomly flip a coin heads or tails 100 times, just write down what you think it would look like. Right. And then people go, you know, heads, tails, heads, tails, heads, tails. And that's not at all what it looks like. You know, it's like heads, 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 tails, 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 heads, tails, heads, 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 heads. There's streaks of like 5, 6, 7 in a row. And people underestimate that randomness. And, you know, like my other favorite example is when the iPod Shuffle was first introduced. People complain it's not random. Certain songs are coming up more than other songs that don't ever seem to come up. It's like that's actually
that is
randomness.
Random. Yeah.
Yeah. So Jobs and company had to program in, you know, make it seem random, and it was actually less random, right?
Well,
so that every song gets played once per cycle. That's not random, right?
Well, and we see that also with people claiming that their phones are listening to them because an ad that is exact. Just talking about going to Aspen last week, and now there's an ad for it. My phone's listening to me.
Right.
Whereas meanwhile, you know, I went to ChatGPT. I said, I am this old. I am from here. I have lived in these places. I currently live here. I have these age children. I've been married this long. What's my favorite board game? And it named three board games that I love.
Really?
It's like, apparently we're not that hard to figure out as humans.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So the messiness of life, it's hard to see it because so much of it is random. Like we were talking about, you know, the narrative in hindsight and biography bias, it doesn't seem like that is the way life goes. It seems like it should be in some more controlled pattern. So the conspiracy theory is a way of mapping that onto the messiness of life. And, you know, it works that way for a lot of things, and it's more comforting. I mean, if you think like what's more threatening, that the, you know, 18-foot lizard aliens are running the world, or that actually nobody's in charge. Nobody really understands why we have inflation and what to do about it. No economist or political scientist can predict more than 5 years out. You know, the studies on super forecasters. These are the people trained in Bayesian reasoning and signal detection theory. They're really thoughtful about how to predict any kind of specific thing. You know, will Putin invade Ukraine, say, 2 years ago? You know, more than 5 years out, nobody's better than 50-50. Because of just the randomness, right? So the conspiracy theory cuts through all that and says, no, no, it's these 18 guys in London called the Illuminati. They're running the show. Bill Gates and George Soros, they got it all covered, right?
This is a universal question I try to ask everybody. What's a time that you were deeply surprised that something turned out to be true or not true, that you had firmly held on to up until that moment?
Well, I was more confident and trusting in our government. Until I started researching the conspiracy book, and it's like, wait, the CIA was doing what?
Yeah.
Assassinating foreign leaders, rigging elections? Our government was spying on Martin Luther King Jr.? What?
And these are all backed up with receipts.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, no, totally. Yeah.
No, they tried to make him kill himself.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. We have the letter. Yeah, anyway. So a lot of that, you know, it's like, okay, so a lot of conspiracy theories turn out to be true. Right. There are conspiracies. Two or more people plotting in secret to do something to a third party without their consent or knowledge. That's a conspiracy. Happens all the time.
Is there a bright line that people can use as a heuristic to kind of gauge whether or not it's a conspiracy likely to be confirmed or not? Or
the more people that have to be involved, the less likely the conspiracy theory is true. The more elements that have to come together at just the right time and place, less likely the theory is to be true. The more complex and grandiose it is, you know, like world domination, less likely it is to be true. If it's like we want to cheat the emission standards so we can make more money like Volkswagen did. That's pretty simple.
Yeah. One actor, one
why are
goal.
They doing it? They want to make more money. Oh, that's a shocker, right?
So in other words, the more boring the conspiracy, the more likely it is to be real.
Yeah, I mean, Watergate break-in, you know, there's a couple of guys, didn't they fuck that, right? That's a normal conspiracy. That's what happens. And we saw what happened, right? You know, 19 guys with box cutters. How could they do this? You know, bring down the World Trade Center building. That is the only way it could happen, right? Yeah. If you had 1,000 operatives controlled by the Bush administration, and they all had to be at the right place at the right time and plant the explosive devices in just the floors that the planes were going to hit, the radio control planes, and everybody had to communicate and coordinate the whole thing. It'd be like a Darren Brown special, right? It's like, come on. Impossible. And furthermore, what else would be true? Well, you're telling me not one of these 1,000 people wants to go on 60 Minutes and go, hey, let me tell you exactly. Or some woman, I was dating the guy and he told me the whole story and here it is. And here's his letter to me, whatever. And the WikiLeaks, you know, millions of top secret classified documents, not one mention of 9/11 as an inside job, nothing about the fake moon landing, nothing about UFOs at Area 51, which you would predict would be in there.
So you're saying WikiLeaks is fake.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, Flat Earth fascinates me as a conspiracy, mostly because it has to kind of, by its very nature, be the Voltron of a bunch of other conspiracy theories. Like you have to believe, if you believe in a Flat Earth, you also have to believe that the government or an extra governmental organization is in charge of the media, and that's the reason why maps are what they are and photos and videos that disseminate. So it's like, it really is this destination of you believing all of these other things that you think make the world either make more sense, or you are desperate, much like my friend Brian Brushwood is not fooled about the HBO show, The Rehearsal. You are desperate to not be fooled.
It's definitely a magic trick.
You are desperate to not be fooled by the the fact that, the Earth is obviously flat. And so everybody else is stupid, and I am brilliant.
It's one of the hard ones to believe. You know, I mean, you've seen that little graphic of the solar system with all the round planets, and then the little square flat Earth. It's like, well, that was awkward.
I wonder if I am firmly of the belief that most people at least begin being flat earthers because it is about as intellectually punk rock as you can get. If you want to get into arguments all day long, just download these 30 questions, be that guy at the party, and watch people get spun up and pay attention to you.
I always thought that Flat Earth is compelling because the actual conspiracy is they're hiding it from us. right? And there's a lot of they're hiding it from us in our lives. That's real, right? Like you pointed out, there are government secrets that come out that are rumors and whispers and, mm-hmm. and somebody who did a thing and wrote an article in a magazine 30 years ago. And then 30 years on, we find the actual documents that say that they were right. Yeah, so there yeah, is a lot yeah, of they're hiding yeah. it from us, but what's
and
the
sometimes they oldest, are hiding it from
what's
us.
What's the oldest?
That's the hard part.
Yeah. But what's the oldest, most ancient thing that they capital T-H-E-Y, could be hiding from us? The shape of the earth. Yes. Like, nothing is more grandiose and sacred than that.
If you go
that.
Out there and look, it looks flat. Doesn't look like it's cursed.
Yeah, yeah. Trust right. your eyes.
Yeah.
One last question. I've watched you in a number of appearances talk to a wide variety of folks of different positions on the skeptical spectrum. And you seem to have a wonderful talent of not pushing back, not meeting force with force, but instead you tend to Bruce Lee. Somebody will hit you with the moon's not real. And then, and you know, like water, you'll bend and you'll say, you know what? Many people thought that, including so-and-so or whatever. When did you, first of all, assuming I'm reading it right, when did you embrace that and where does that come from and how do you do that?
It's the Bruce Lee method. It's all water.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly, right?
That's be great. Water, my
no
friend.
No one's ever made that analogy. Thank you. I'll take that because he's one of the greats. All right. Well, so for, it's more probably temperament. It's just I'm not super confrontational just by temperament. And also I'm interested in why people believe the things that they believe in, not just tell them that it's bullshit and debunk it, but like, why would you believe that, right? So a lot of these people, they send me these theories of everything. I'm taking to posting them on Twitter now. You know, Hawking was wrong and Einstein was wrong and Newton was wrong, but I've worked this thing out. You know, it's like, okay, you know. Do you realize there's other people that send me these every week, right?
Right.
You're not the only one. Why would you believe that? Did you go to your high school physics teacher and ask him before you, you know, announce to the world you have this new theory? Anyway, so I just like the kind of the curiosity of, you know, what led you to believe that. And also when I was young, I believed most of this stuff. In fact, back to Randy, you know, when I was in graduate school the first time in experimental psychology, and my mentor was super materialist and reductionist. There's none of this paranormal, supernatural, that's all nonsense. But I was reading about Thelma Moss's lab at UCLA, paranormal lab, Curlian photography and altered states of consciousness and out-of-body experiences, all the Spoon Betty, Uri Geller, you know, this was in the 70s, right? And I was seeing all this stuff. This is amazing. Maybe there's something to it. Maybe my mentor is just too narrow and maybe science is too restricted and there's this other realm. Who am I to, you know, what do I know? Nothing. So I was pretty open to it until I saw Randy do a bunch of the stuff that Geller was doing. You know, that's what he did on The Tonight Show. I went, oh, huh. Okay. So maybe I'm being fooled here. That's what kind of pushed me down the skeptical route a little bit.
Do you think there's a bias for people in sports of all varieties to want to believe in pseudoscientific things?
No, well, athletes are notoriously superstitious because whatever works for them.
Exactly.
At that moment,
yeah.
You know, it's just, but you know, N of one. So yeah. And I tried all that stuff. I tried all kinds of crazy alternative things just to see performance differences. Athletes are bad about that.
What's one that you look back and you're most surprised that you were into?
Well, see, there was this iridology where you get your iris red. You know, they look
like
at the
fingerprint.
Specks on your eyes and, oh, your kidney is bad. I'm like, my kidney's down there. What are you talking about? Right. Anyway, so some of that stuff was just kind of crazy, but it was exploratory. But back to your question, I am deeply curious why people believe it. So I like to, in any case, I think it works as a strategy, like instead of telling somebody that's all bullshit, you know, just, well, where did you hear that? Or what would it take to change your mind? You know, and usually they go, huh, I never thought about that. Like, yeah. And if you just let that sit, rather than saying, I'm going to now debunk you and humiliate you in front of your friends, which is, you know, the wall's going to go up. They're not going to talk to you anymore. Just think about this. You know, maybe I'm wrong. I could be wrong. You might be right. Oh, really?
Yeah.
You know, just saying that, because it's possible. I'm not omniscient. What do I know? Right? I don't know everything.
One of the things that we come to at the end of this season in trying to discuss Randy and specifically his role in Project Alpha, how he did make it so much larger than it would have been otherwise, even if he didn't totally run it in the way that the popular legend, largely crafted by Randy, says, is explaining how much he meant to the skeptic movement as a whole. And Project Alpha did a lot to help him, you know, propel him to that position. And specifically looking at the skeptic movement through the aughts and early tens, where the Amazing Meeting was something that was a big movement. It seemed like it was having a moment in the sun. Books, you know, were it felt like two or three times a year, major celebrities were that hadn't normally dabbled in that were now writing in this field. And then the Amazing Meeting kind of wanes. Randy takes a step back. Randy is now no longer with us. And it feels like, at least to me, somebody that kind of left the skeptic community actively many years ago, it seems far more tribal and atomized than it was at that moment. But I'm not you. You are one of the people, the titans of that industry. I was curious your perspective to that idea.
I think, like most social movements, it goes through different phases and they do splinter. A lot of, you know, feminists or Marxists, Ayn Rand objectivists, you know, they all splinter and fight. There's a lot of infighting. I've noticed this back when I was reading a lot of Ayn Rand, and then there was like some story about how she's kicking people out of the group because they're not objectivists enough. They're not libertarian enough. And then some libertarian telling some other libertarian, you're a Marxist for this one little thing. You might just like, you know, this isn't too healthy, right? And then I saw atheists do this. You know, first of all, atheism was not a big thing all the way up until the late 90s. You know, when the science wars kind of took off and science and religion, ooh, okay. And then Dawkins' book really flipped it, you know, along with a few of the other, the four horsemen, so to speak, but they weren't the only ones, but really Dawkins. And then it was like a split, like, are you militant enough in your atheism? So that was one cut. And then there was atheism plus, which is you also have to be a social justice warrior and have these embrace, fully embrace 100% these kind of far left, woke, progressive political issues that have nothing to do with atheism. Right. It's like, why is this happening? This, you know, we're a pretty small tent, right?
it does seem like the natural order of things is the moment you get into a clubhouse, you have to figure out what are the sub clubhouses, you know?
Right.
It's I don't know if you've read The Status Game by Will Storer, but oh boy, that's a good one. Put a pin in that. Michael Shermer, thank you for all of your time. This has been absolutely amazing. Thank you for the kind words that you said about World's Greatest Con. What can we promote for you?
Oh, well, I'm interested in cons. Yeah, I have talked to a lot of my guests on the show. And I'm going to have you guys on again here. We do this. We'll do this again, but I'm going to dig deeper into cons because really it comes down to, you know, what do people believe and why and how irrational are we? To me, that's really interesting. Anyway, michaelshermer.com, skeptic.com is, you know, the webpage for the magazine and my books on Amazon, whatever. Yeah.
Right now it's Conspiracy is the latest one.
Conspiracy, yeah. Why the rational believe the irrational.
Excellent.
Yeah, so I am deciding that people are rational. Well, then why did they believe irrational things? Okay, I'll show you how they do it. Right?
Perfect. Can't wait.
Fantastic.
All right.
Thank you, Michael.
Bye, gentlemen.
This episode of World's Greatest Con is written by Justin Robert Young and me, Brian Brushwood, your humble host. Production and research by Dog and Pony Show Audio in Austin, Texas, with additional production by Will Saddleberg. Original music by Carson Pace. Support us directly and keep the World's Greatest Cons coming by heading on over to patreon.com/greatestcon. Get an ad-free feed, early access to information, and behind-the-scenes extras. Very special thanks go to Banachek and Mike Edwards for allowing us to tell their story. We greatly encourage you to see Banachek's new show, Mind Games, at the Strat Hotel and Casino on the Las Vegas Strip. Additional thanks go to George Slatter Productions, which, along with contemporary news articles, retrospectives, and archive videos, made for the bulk of our research. Write us to worldsgreatestcon@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership.
Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.